as if he had dug it himself, and after a few yards they emerged into a much broader, older working. The prints of his boots were stamped in the damp earth underfoot, as if he had come and gone along it many times. "Not scared of the dark, I hope?" he asked cheerfully. "Of course not," said Fever. What did he take her for? Another of his children? But she walked a little faster all the same. It was very cold in the tunnel. The light from their two lanterns lit up the low brick roof and the timber buttressing which lined the walls. Before long the timber gave way to rusty metal, ribbed like the throat of a whale, and slick with moisture. Not so much a tunnel as an enormous pipe. "This passageway was dug by Auric Godshawk, I believe," said Kit Solent. "It linked the Barbican with a house he owned outside the city. The Barbican end of it is all filled in now. Katie and I heard rumours about it years ago. Then 2 summers back there was a cave-in in one of the streets higher up the hill. A section of pavement collapsed into what people thought was just an old digger's working. The hole was filled in, but I guessed at once that it was Godshawk's tunnel, and I worked out the likely course it took beneath the city. I took the house in Ludgate Hill Gardens because its cellar was as close as I could get to the line of the old tunnel. Then it was just a question of digging until I hit it. The tunnel itself was in pretty good repair, just a few roof falls to deal with, a few leaks to plug. "How far does it go?" asked Fever, peering into the darkness ahead. "About 2 miles. I hope you're feeling fit." 2 miles, thought Fever. That would put their destination well outside the southern edge of London, deep in the brick marsh. "Does anyone else know about it?" she asked. "No," Kit replied. "Godshawk had the labourers who built it put to death, and any of his scriven friends who knew about it were murdered in the Skinner's riots. You're honoured, Fever. Apart from me, you're the only person in London who knows this is here." For some unreasonable reason, that made Fever uneasy. As they walked on, she began to feel more and more aware of the darkness that was pressing in behind her. She looked back once or twice and saw it flooding after her along the tunnel, repossessing the places that her passing lamp had briefly lit. She remembered accounts that she had read about the London under London, a midnight maze of tunnels dug by generations of scavenger archaeologists, linking up in places with far older networks, the winding processional deepways of the raffia hat culture, and even sections of the ancient underground system. There were tales of blind white savages living in the deepest shafts, the descendants of people who had sought shelter there from the downsizing and never found their way out. Fever did not believe such yarns, of course, but each time a stone fell in the dark behind her she started and walked a little faster, anxious not to be left behind. After a long while the tunnel started to rise, and they stepped through a doorway into a big underground space. It was brick-built, this place, and flagstone-floored, like the deep cellar of some important old building. There was a toolbox standing in the middle of the floor, along with some spare lanterns and an oil-stained rag or two. In the far wall, a big steel door was set. Around the edges, where it met the heavy doorframe, bright scars and gouges showed where someone had tried, with a variety of tools, to prise it open. "Impressive, eh?" said Kit Solent, holding his lantern up to light Fever's face and watching her reactions as she studied the strange door. "I've been trying for months to get that open. I finally got a drill through it, but it looks as if there's another door behind it, and likely a third behind that, and they're all reinforced and made of something that grinds my drill bits flat in no time." Fever glanced quickly around the underground chamber. It was empty except for Kit's tools and lamps and that great steel portal, like the door to a colossal safe. "What's in there?" she asked. "I'm not entirely sure," said Solent, with a shrug that made the lantern light shrug too. "But the old villain must have been keeping something in there to make it worth erecting such a door." Fever looked at him. He was still watching her. This was Godshawk's. Kit Solent nodded. "Look closer, please." Fever was surprised to be asked. She put down her lantern and went over to the door. She saw the places where drills had gnawed at the metal. Otherwise it was in good condition, unrusted and undented, shining coldly in the lamplight. It was not new, but nor was it very old. There were no handles or hinges, so she guessed that it was meant to slide open. On the heavy frame to the right of the door, on the same level as her eyes, she saw a row of ivory studs or buttons, each printed with a single number. "Electronics," she said to herself. She had heard of electronic locks, but never seen one. They were deep old tech. No one nowadays knew how to create the minute chips and circuits which controlled such a device, so to make one you needed a piece of ancient technology which still worked, and such treasures were rare and wildly valuable. She turned and found Kit Solent watching her with an expression she did not know how to read. It looked almost as if he were afraid of her. "This is electronic keypad, Master Solent," she said awkwardly. "You would have to know the code. Without it, I don't see any way of opening this door. If you keep drilling at it, you might damage it. You might make it impossible to open even with the code."
"And what is the code, Fever?" Solent asked.
It was an absurd question. But strangely, it did not feel absurd. For a second, Fever actually thought about it, as if she might know, while Kit Solent watched her steadily with his eyes shining in the light from the lanterns. Then the moment passed. He laughed and said, "Come, let's get some fresh air, and I'll explain." There was another door in that underground room, so small and ordinary that Fever had not noticed it. It was made from planks of wood, and its handle was a worn ivory egg that seemed to her peculiarly familiar. Kit Solent turned the handle and opened the door, and held it for Fever to go through, then followed her up a long wind of brick stairs, with Fever's shadow, cast by the light of his lantern, laid up them like a carpet.
"Can you guess what lies behind that door that we've been trying to open, Fever?"
"No, Master Solent."
"It is a workroom. It is Godsork's room, where he worked on his secret inventions. It was a secret itself, even during the rule of the Scriven."
"Godsork," said Fever.
And for some reason she imagined a low, unwindowed room, ribbed with stone buttresses, and brass lamps shaped like lilies hanging from the roof.
"I did not know Godsork was an inventor. I thought he was insane."
"He was a Scriven. They were all insane, judged by our human standards. But they loved tinkering with the old machines and making new ones. Your order never approved. The Scriven were too playful, not scientific enough. Perhaps to them engineering was a sort of art. And Auric Godsork was a very great artist indeed." They came to the stairs' top and another door. This one of metal, sealed with immense bolts. They were old and rust-stained, but they had been recently oiled, and Fever slid them open and leaned against the door and was dazzled by daylight. She stepped out into long, wet grass. The door was set into the side of a low, squarish hill, and almost hidden by evergreen shrubs that someone must have planted all around it. Pushing her way out through their wet needles, Fever turned and shielded her eyes against the brightness of the day and looked about, trying to understand where she was. Up on the hill's top stood the stubs and shards of a ruined building. Around the base of the hill the sun shone wanly on the waters of the brick marsh, formed during the earth storms of the previous century when the old River Thames had changed its course and spilled away southward, drowning London's southern boroughs in a wide wilderness of reed beds, wetlands and lagoons. Kit propped the door ajar and started to climb up the hill's side, and Fever followed. "Godsork built his home on this hill," said Solent. "It was called Nonsuch House. Long before the Scriven chose him as their leader, he had his villa here. Even then, when he had his royal apartments in the Barbican, this was always the place he loved the best."
The hill went up in grassy terraces, a green ziggurat. They passed fallen statues flocked with moss, and skirted strange shallow pools. At the top stood what remained of Nonsuch House, fire-scorched jagged crusts of wall, a mass of charred timber and smashed roof tiles and tangled weeds filling the spaces between them, a blackbird clattering in a bramble bush. But Fever, as she looked in through the empty windows, saw Scriven nobles in evening robes and their women in gowns like vast blousy flowers, crowding the big rooms, spilling out onto the lawns to watch glowing paper lanterns loft into the air. She shut her eyes and forced the vision away. What was wrong with her today?
"It is very unfashionable now to say that the Scriven created anything of worth," said Kit Solent.
He picked up a shard of floor tile, looked at it, and let it fall.
"And it's true that most of the things Godsork tried to invent were crazy. New colours, flying machines, devices for recording dreams. He spent most of his spare time tinkering with stalkers' brains. He dissected the last of the Scriven's stalker warriors in the course of his researches, which is one of the reasons they could not defend themselves when the riots began. But he worked on other things as well, and I believe that one of them still exists, buried in that vault down there beneath us."
Fever turned around, taking in the view and trying to ignore the strange feelings that the place aroused in her.
"Feelings mean nothing. Stop feeling and think." A wash of sunlight silvered the far-off roofs of Ludgate Hill.
"I'm surprised that no one has found this place before," she said.
"The causeway which linked this hill to London has been cut," said Solent. "The way across the lagoons is hazardous. The vault was a secret even in Godsork's day. No one knows that it is here. And the door in the hillside was completely overgrown. I could never have found it from outside." So how did you learn of it? Stories? Rumours? It seems irrational to buy a house and dig a tunnel simply because of stories.
But I found the vault, didn't I? Said Kit Solent triumphantly. Now it is just a question of getting inside. Of course I could announce my discovery. I know people who would be happy to take the top off this hill and use brute force and gunpowder to get into Godsork's inner sanctum. But I don't like such methods. I want to try a subtler approach. And I think you can help me, Fever Crumb.
Chapter 8. Skinner's Boy. Too shy to speak, Charlie went silently after Bagman Creech through the busy straggle market. He hung back, quiet and watchful, while the Skinner talked to some of the stallholders there, listening to their accounts of the strange-looking girl who had come their way that morning, and the sedan chair, which some believed had smuggled her away.
"It was Bert Atkinson's chair," said one man. "I'm surprised at him, aiding a dirty patch skin like that."
"We have no proof that she was a scriven," Bagman Creech reminded him. "That is for me to find out. And it was not the chairman who aided her, but their passenger, the man who hired them."
He glanced upward, judging the time by the way the sun hit the tops of the old warehouses above him.
"I'll be taking a little refreshment at the Scary Monster. Pass word for this Atkinson to come and find me there."
The Scary Monster and Super Creep was a big tavern halfway down Cripplegate. It was set back from the street with tables arranged outside under a dim, see-through canopy made from salvaged plastic. It wasn't the class of place where Charlie thought he would be welcome. But Bagman Creech looked back at him and jerked his head to show that Charlie should come with him. They sat down together at one of the tables and studied each other in the brownish light that came through the plastic roof.
"You look hungry, boy," said Bagman Creech. "Ted Swiney given you any breakfast today?"
Ted Swiney hadn't, but Charlie wasn't going to admit it, in case word of his disloyalty got back to the publican.
"I'm all right, Master Creech," he said.
A soft cough rumbled like far-off thunder down behind the Skinner's ribs. He blinked his pale eyes at Charlie.
"I remember being mostly hungry when I was a boy."
Charlie, caught off balance by the sudden notion that Bagman Creech had once been a boy, said,
"That must have been a long time ago, Master Creech."
Bagman Creech started to laugh, and kept on laughing until the laugh turned into a long choking spasm. He retched like a cat with a furball, and coughed up a big blood-veined pearl of phlegm that he spat onto the flagstones under the table.
"It was that, Charlie,"
he whispered hoarsely, wiping his eyes with his shirt cuffs.
"It was a long, long time ago, and food was scarce for normal folks in them days, for the Scriven ruled this town, and took all the good things for themselves and their cronies. And that's why I was mostly hungry then."
Meanwhile, the serving girls, looking like white hens in their crisp aprons and bonnets, had been gathering at the tavern door to gawp at their famous guest and whisper about who would take his order.
"You go, Gertie. No, you go."
Now their mistress, the Scary Monster's fat landlady, shoved her way between them and hurried to Bagman's side to curtsy and twitter.
"Oh, Master Creech, this is an honour. How can we serve you, good Master Creech?"
"Well, mistress," said Bagman Creech, "I'll take a mug of your porter and a stack of pancakes for my young assistant here."
"Oh, yes, sir,"
fluttered the landlady, looking at Charlie in a way no one had ever looked at him before, as if he meant something.
"And honey,"
called Bagman Creech as she hurried off.
"Plenty of honey."
He looked at Charlie again and smiled. His lean old face was so unused to smiling that Charlie was afraid it might crack and drop off his bones like plaster off a wall. He had long teeth, scuffed and yellowed as the keys of a pub piano.
"Pancakes was my favourite, as I recall," he said. "Honey pancakes, specially."
"Thank you, Master Creech," said Charlie,
whose mouth was watering at just the thought of pancakes. The old man shrugged.
"I generally work alone," he said. "But, well, Ted Swine is a bad man, but there's truth in what he said. Maybe it is time I had a youngster to help me out. How old are you, Charlie?"
11, Master Creech, maybe 12.
"Old enough, then. Got a mum and dad, have you?"
Charlie shook his head. For as long as he could remember, he'd just hung around the Mott and Hoople, sleeping in the cellar or the yard out back, doing odd jobs for Ted Swiney, eating what scraps he could find. Probably his mother had been one of Ted's servant girls, but he didn't remember her. Who his dad was, only the gods of London knew. Bagman Creech coughed thoughtfully.
"And you wouldn't be too broken-hearted, I'm guessing, if you never had to go back to Ted Swiney's employ.
Oh, no, Master Creech.
"'Cause I'm like you, Charlie, all alone. And it seems to me that maybe it's time I started training up some young fella to take over my job when I'm too old to do it any more. How would you like that, Charlie, to sign on as my apprentice?"
"What, an unpatched skins, Master Creech? I don't think I'd be brave enough."
"I didn't think I'd be brave enough, Charlie, when I was your tender age. But the time comes when you just have to do what's needful."
He stopped, coughing a little and thumping his chest with a fist. The pancakes had arrived, a tower of them, golden brown and crispy at the edges, with honey in a pot to drizzle over them. Charlie started rolling them up one by one and cramming them into his mouth.
"Killing a scriven isn't like killing a human being,"
Bagman explained.
"They aren't made like us and they don't think like us. And if you let them live and breed, there might come a time when it'll be them hunting us and our kind hiding in the dark. You have to remember that. It's difficult sometimes. Take this one we're after. If we corner her, she's going to look almost like an ordinary girl. You've got to be ready for that. She might look pretty. She might say, 'Please don't harm me.' She might say, 'Please have mercy.' And you've got to be ready for that. You mustn't let pity creep in. You've got to keep telling yourself it ain't no different to killing rats."
He reached inside his coat with a quick, well-practiced movement, and suddenly there was a weapon in his hand. A long, ugly thing like the skeleton of a gun, with a big, oil-shiny spring inside it and a ratchet to wind the spring back. More notches than Charlie could count had been cut into its worn plastic hand grip.
"This is a spring gun,"
said Bagman solemnly, holding it so the light slithered over its shining surfaces.
"Those scriven wouldn't let anyone but themselves own firearms, and we couldn't have afforded firearms anyway. But some of us worked in machine shops. So in our off hours we made these, in secret-like. A spring gun will chuck a dart hard enough and far enough to cut a scriven down. And when they were down, we'd flay their skins off. Not to stop their spirit coming back, the way the foolish people tell it, but more by way of a trophy, to show the rest of London that Scriven died as easy as the rest of us."
Charlie wanted to hold the gun. He wanted to aim it at imaginary Scriven and imagine himself back in those glorious days, slaughtering patchskins and making London safe for ordinary Londoners again. But just then he became aware of a man edging up to the table. A big man with the broad shoulders and over-muscled arms of a sedan chair-bearer. He was looking sheepishly at Bagman Creech and turning his cap around and around in his hands.
"Master Creech," he asked, "I'm Bert Atkinson, taxi-bearer. I heard you want a word."
Bagman Creech took a slurp of porter and nodded as he gulped it down.
"That's right, and thank you, Master Atkinson. You know what this is about, I take it."
The chairman twisted his cap in both fists as if he were wringing it out. "They're saying that girl we took aboard down Straggle Market was a patchskin. I'd never have had her in my chair if I'd known."
"No one blames you, I'm sure, Bert," said the skinner. "But what I'd like to know is, who was the fare you were carrying? The one who made you take the girl aboard?"
Atkinson looked deeply thoughtful for a moment, and Charlie started to fear that he had forgotten. Chair-bearers doped themselves with powerful drugs to give themselves the strength to carry their burdens around the city. They weren't famous for quick thinking, or even thinking at all. But Atkinson's face brightened, and he said, "Picked him up at the tram terminus this morning. A gentleman, by the way, he talked. He had two nippers with him, and he told us to follow the girl, which was easy on account of her big, huge straw hat."
"And when you picked the girl up, where did he have you take her?"
"Why, to his home, sir. They all got out together. One of them old crumble-down patch-skin manses up on the heights. Ludgate Hill Gardens, I think."
Creech nodded calmly.
"Your help's highly appreciated, Master Atkinson. Highly appreciated."
Charlie was halfway down his pancake pile, honey running off his chin.
"What now, Master Creech?" he asked stickily, as the chair-bearer went away. "Do we go and talk to this bloke?"
Bagman Creech looked at him, or maybe through him, thinking.
"Not yet," he said. "We want to go careful-like. If this bald-headed Finch is Scriven, and he's a shelter in her, we don't want to put him on his guard. We'll ask around and work out who he is, and who she is, and what he wants with her. Hopefully it'll turn out poor old Lily Dismas was mistaken. But if not, we'll have to do what's needful."
He drained his mug and stood up, already scanning the passers-by as if one of them might have the answers that he needed. He picked up his stick and leaned on it while he waited for Charlie to mop up the last of the honey.
"Down these mean streets a man must go," he said.
And it sounded to Charlie like the start of something, like a quotation or something. But he didn't say any more, just nodded and grunted and set off walking. Chapter 9. The Scent Lantern. To Fever's relief, there was no more talk of opening the Godsawk vault that day. She walked with Kit Solent among the mist and ruins on the hilltop, and then went back beneath the hill. Since they had no water with them, she accepted a drink of cold, strong tea from Kit's pocket flask, and perhaps that was what made her feel giddy and slightly overexcited on the long walk back to Ludgate Hill. Toward evening, the sun peeped in under the quilt of cloud that had settled over London in the afternoon. It spilled gold light into the overgrown gardens of Kit Solent's house, and into his drawing room, where he sat with his daughter on his knee and his son at his feet, and told a most unlikely story full of giants and heroes and lightsabers and gingerbread houses. Fever watched him, and wondered how a rational man could waste so much time talking such nonsense to children. She tried not to listen to the story, and when she found that she was listening anyway, and that she was quite eager to hear whether the hero rescued his princess, she made herself say good night and go upstairs to bed. It was dangerous, this house. She felt that if she let down her guard, she would find herself enjoying all its luxuries and irrational little pleasures, and who knew where that would lead. She had often heard Dr. Crumb and the other engineers talk about Thaniel Wormtimber, who had been a good engineer himself before he left the Head and let himself be corrupted by the city. She did not want to end up like him, lost in London's maze of unreason. Her bedroom was on the top floor of the house. It had sloping ceilings, and when the wind blew, the rafters creaked and the roof tiles rattled. There was a vase of cut flowers on the bedside table, which was irrational, and a potted plant on the windowsill, which was not, because Fever knew that it would absorb some of the carbon dioxide she breathed out and help to replenish the air with oxygen. The bed was very large and soft, quite unlike the hard little cot that she was used to. On the wall above it hung another picture of Kit Solent's dead wife, looking much younger than she did in the picture downstairs, in a frame carved in the shapes of hearts and roses. Fever carefully took the picture down, since it served no purpose. As she was propping it against the wall over in the room's far corner, she noticed the little handwritten label on the back, which read, "Miss Katie Unthank." That must have been Katie Solent's name before Kit married her, Fever thought, remembering the irrational custom which made women take the name of their husbands. Unthank. She knew it at once. The digger whom Dr. Crumb had gone to visit on the day he found her had been called Unthank. She thought for a moment, wondering if there was some link, then dismissed it as coincidence. For all she knew, Unthank was a common name. She put on her night things and blew out the candle and lay on the big, soft bed, waiting for sleep. Downstairs she heard the voices of the children as their father tucked them in, and then, after a little more time, the sounds of Kit Solent making his own way to bed. After that there was only silence, the creaking of the old house, the distant noises of the city. But Fever could not sleep. However hard she tried to clear her mind of thoughts, they kept sneaking back in. She had had an eventful day, perhaps the most eventful day of her life, and it was hard to keep from thinking of it. Katie Solent haunted her thoughts, too. That name, Unthank, could not help but recall to her the story that Dr. Crumb used to tell her when she was little. Was it possible that Katie had had a child before she married Kit? One little girl whom she had abandoned in a basket on the marshes near her father's dig? Was that why Kit had asked Fever into his house? Because he had found out somehow that she was Katie's daughter? And was he her father? She had never wondered before about who her real parents were. Dr. Crumb had told her when she was small that it did not matter, and she believed him. But remembering how cosy little Fern had looked upon her father's lap, she found herself wishing very much that she had grown up with a father like him, and a mother too. "Don't be ridiculous," she told herself, sitting up in bed. She must have been lying there awake for hours. Wanting to clear her head, she got up and lit her candle and padded downstairs to find a glass of water. A faint, haunting musk hung in the air, making her wonder if Kit had left the scent lantern alight when he went up to bed, but when she looked into the drawing-room the lantern was open and unlit. The portrait of Katie Solent smiled down at her from the wall, and she held up the candle for a while and stood there looking at the picture
and at her own reflection in the glass, trying to make out a resemblance. But there was none, and she could not really believe that she was Mistress Solent's daughter. In her memory, just out of reach, was the face of a quite different woman that matched her own much better. Who did she remind herself of? Unsettled, she went to the kitchen for her drink, and then hurried quietly back upstairs. On the first landing, she noticed a door standing open. It had been shut earlier, but Kit Solent must have been in there before he turned in. Fever's curiosity overcame her. She pushed the door wider and stepped through into a library. It was nothing like as large as the Order's library at Godshawk's Head, and many of the volumes looked worthless, novels and poems and fantasy quartets, no good for anything but pulping, yet it was impressive all the same. Bookcases alternated with windows all the way round the room, and through the windows the moon shone, making silver-grey shapes of light on the floorboards. On a table in the centre, a book lay open beside a lit scent lantern, the source of that ghostly smell which still flavoured the air. Fever breathed deeply, intrigued by the musty odour. It was the same scent that Ruin had put on downstairs, or one very like it. And it so nearly reminded Fever of something. She closed her eyes, and the scent seeded her mind with pleasant memories. Dew-wet evening lawns, lilies in bloom on geometric pools, fire balloons lofting into a lilac sky. She shook her head, almost angry at herself. Those were not memories. The image was a fantasy or a half-remembered dream, neither of which had any place in a well-ordered mind. Feeling giddy, she leaned on the table and looked down at the open book. It was a large, old-fashioned volume, with circular pages bound between two discs of leather in the scriven style. On the open page was a drawing, or perhaps a diagram. Fever couldn't make it out at first. She set down her candle and placed her hands on the table on either side of the book, and looked down at the page, and suddenly she was falling into the picture. What was it? What did it show? She could not be sure. Looping lines of smudged pencil swept across the page, bisecting three big interlocking rings. And inside those rings were smaller rings and other forms, small crosses, squares, and shapes that reminded her of cogs and pistons. She wished that Dr. Crumb were there with her. Together, she was sure they would have been able to make sense of it, but even without him, she started to understand that some of those pencil marks meant patterns of force, and she could see how some of those shapes might move inside each other and around each other, and that egg-shaped thing marked D might act as a kind of regulator on the movement of the other pieces. It was an engine, she realized, and with that realization came a blazing star of pain somewhere at the back of her head. She cried out, and the diagram seemed to jump up at her out of the creamy paper and close around her like a net. In the middle of it a red flower appeared, and she straightened up, looking in horror at the splash of blood that had fallen on the drawing. Cupping one hand under her streaming nose, she pulled out her handkerchief and set one corner of it to the bright little splat of blood. The white fabric soaked up most of it, and Fever dabbed carefully at the rest, but she could not get rid of the brown stain that it had left, like an extra cogwheel, in the heart of the diagram. She was still trying when she heard footfalls behind her, and turned guiltily to find Kit Solent standing in the doorway, wearing a quilted nightgown, his long hair loose. "Fever, you poor thing, whatever's happened?" "It's a nosebleed," said Fever. "I'm sorry, I've never had one before. I got blood on the book." Kit Solent strode over to her. He didn't seem to care about the book. He took her handkerchief from her and gave her his own, which seemed as big as a bedsheet, clean and fresh-smelling. "Sit down," he advised, guiding her to a chair. "Tip your head back. Ruin gets these sometimes. It is never as bad as it looks. Yes, the worst is over. I must have left the scent lantern burning when I went to bed. Foolish of me. Perhaps that's what made you feel faint. These old scriven smells are not to everyone's taste." The nosebleed seemed to have stopped. She said, "I'm sorry about the book." "Oh, don't worry about the book," said Kit, kneeling beside her. "I picked it up for a few quid from a bookstall at Rag Fair years ago. It's just one of Godshawk's old notebooks. Dozens of them were looted from the Barbican after the riots." Fever nodded. "Dr. Isbister has some at the Order's Library." "I bought it because it looked interesting. I don't really understand what it's about." "Do those old drawings mean anything to you?" He asked it casually, but Fever sensed a kind of eagerness under the words. Had he left the book out in the hope that she would come in and see it? She lowered her head cautiously and looked at him. But she could see nothing in his face except kindness and honest concern for her. Then she noticed something else. Behind him, the rugs of moonlight that had lain on the floor beneath each window were gone. Outside, above the rooftops, the sky was growing pale.
"What is the time?" she asked. "Almost sunrise," said Kit Solent. "There's hardly any point going back to bed. Shall I sort out some breakfast?"
"But that can't be..." Fever went to the closest window and looked out. It was true. While she had sat staring at that diagram, the whole night had passed. Behind the barbican, the sun was coming up. Chapter 10 Summertown. Kit Solent did not take Fever back to Godsork's secret vault that day. He had been troubled by her confusion when he stood her before the locked door the day before, and also by the events of the night. He had hoped that the scent lantern and the book would have some effect, but the blood and the girl's obvious distress had upset him. He was a kindly man, and for all her solemn, engineerish ways, Fever seemed a child to him, not so very much different from Fern or Ruin. It felt horrible to see her frightened, and to know that he was to blame. He thought a day of rest was in order before he tried again. "No school today," he announced over breakfast that morning, "and no work neither. We'll go to Summertown instead." "Summertown!" shouted Fern and Ruin happily. "Summertown?" said Fever, far from certain. She knew what it was, a great triangle of waste ground up in Clerkenwell, where every summer the wandering land barges stopped to dazzle the citizens of London with sideshows and trade goods. She had often watched the barges rumbling along the Westerway and the Great South Road, and Dr. Crumb had told her much about the engines that powered them, but as for Summertown itself... "Is it not a rather irrational place?" she asked. "If fun is irrational," said Kit Solent, through a mouthful of toast, "if colour and excitement and good things from far places are irrational, then yes. But I think you'll find it educational, Fever, and I'm sure the children will. Come, you can explain to us how all the engines work." "Yes, sir," said Fever, lowering her head.
"You're still worried about what happened yesterday," said Kit kindly. "I'm not surprised. But Summertown is not the straggle market, and you'll be with us, not on your own. Anyway, everyone will have forgotten you by now." But Fever was not sure about that. As she left the house an hour later, for it took an extraordinarily long time for Kit Solent and his children to get ready, she noticed two figures standing on the opposite pavement, a ragged boy and an old man in a long black coat and a black bowler hat. They did not do anything. They did not try to accost her. Indeed, they drew back shyly into the shadows of an alley as Kit Solent let her out through the gates, and she knew that he had not seen them, but she could sense their eyes on her as she followed him along the street. It made her uneasy, and she did not know why. From the far side of the street, Charlie Shallow watched the girl go by. She strode along mannishly at the gentleman's side, with her hat in her hand and her bald head bared for all to see. She looked human enough to him, and pretty, almost. He glanced at Bagman, hoping for some clue as to how he should react.
"I can't see no speckles on her, Master Creech."
"No, boy."
"So does that mean she's a human being after all?" Charlie tried not to sound disappointed. He was half relieved that Bagman wouldn't have to kill the girl, but at the same time he found himself thinking that if Bagman had no prey to hunt, he might not need apprentice any more.
"I'm not sure," said Bagman. "There were some scriven who didn't have many markings. A few had no markings on their faces at all. Blanks, we called them. I remember cornering a female like that once, and she held a baby that might have passed for human."
Charlie waited for him to say more, but the old man fell silent. He started to realise what a terrible responsibility it was to be a skinner. Bagman had turned away, watching as the man and the children and the girl went on up the street, climbing toward Cripplegate. When they were out of sight, he shook his head and gave a few soft, doubtful coughs.
"Strangest thing," he said quietly, perhaps to himself. "Always before, I could tell at a glance. Even if I couldn't see no markings, I could always tell a scriven by the way they held themselves, the way they moved. But this one, I ain't sure."
"So what do we do, Master Creech?"
"We follows her, boy, and we gets a closer look."
It was startling to come out of the quiet streets into the bustle of Cripplegate. Fever had expected Kit Solent to turn uphill toward the wind tram terminus, but instead he simply stepped out into the mud of the roadway and raised one hand, and at once a sedan chair swerved toward him out of the passing scrum of drays, chairs and pedestrians. He pulled the door open before it had even stopped. The children bundled inside, and as Fever scrambled after them, she heard him call out to the bearers, "Summertown!" The men did not reply, simply started trotting, turning off Cripplegate as soon as they could,
and cutting westward through the complicated little streets of Pimlico and Chelsea. Several times, through gaps between the buildings, Fever caught a glimpse of Godshawk's head, picked out from the clutter of rooftops and chimneys further north by stray beams of sunlight. "Would you like to stop in at home on the way?" asked Kit Solent, noticing how she craned her head to keep it in sight. "Godshawk's head is not on the way to Clerkenwell. We could make a detour. I thought you might want to look in on Dr. Crumb and let him know that you were all right." Fever wanted nothing more. But from across the city, Godshawk's steel face seemed to be staring sternly at her, reminding her that she must be rational and not let down her order. She said, "There would be no purpose in such a visit. I'm sure Dr. Crumb knows that you would contact the order if there were any problem." Kit Solent started to say something, then changed his mind and sat in silence, smiling to himself, watching Fever strain for another glimpse of home. He liked her, her primness and her bravery. It was a shame, he thought, that those dry old tech botherers at the head had never let her have a proper childhood. He did not think to look behind him, through the small window in the rear wall of the chair. If he had, he might have seen another taxi chair following, not far behind. Ruin couldn't believe that Fever had never been to Summertown. "What, never?" he kept asking her, as if there was a chance that she had been but had forgotten, as if anyone could forget Summertown. To Ruin, there was simply nothing in the world that mattered more than the land barges. Each Maytime, as the snows of winter melted, he would start to listen for the grumble of their engines on the Great South Road. He would lie in his bed in the quiet of early morning and strain his ears to catch that first distant whisper. Sometimes, when a convoy had been sighted, Daddy would take him down to Bankment Side, and they would stand together and watch the great pachydermous vehicles passing, big as houses, big as castles, their tracks ingrained with the mud of Europe, and their upper works dusted by the sands of far-off Asia. There were big lumbering cargo hoys like herds of sauropods, but Ruin's favourites were the gaudy, speedy tinker barges and travelling fairs. Half the size of the sluggish hoys, and twice as fast, they were painted in a million lurid shades, decked out with flags and chrome and mirrors, and hung each night with strings of saffron lanterns. Dizzy opart spirals whirled on their wheel hubs, and their exhaust stacks were striped like gypsies' stockings, and along their sides, in cut-out letters as high as house fronts, they wore their names: Mar Gumbo's Travelin' Rarey Show, The Dark Lantern, The Paradise Circus, A Dream of Fair Women. He did his best to explain all this to Fever while the chair joggled them through the rookeries of Lemon Heel. He wasn't sure that she understood. She was a strange person, and he couldn't help wondering if she was a bit stupid, even though Daddy had told him she was clever. But she was very pretty. He thought she was the prettiest person he had ever seen, so he didn't want to think that she was stupid. Perhaps she was just shy, and that was why she didn't seem interested when he told her about the barge with the big dragon's head at the front, or the magician who made rabbits and ribbons appear out of his hat. They crossed the Westerway, and the chair slowed as it joined the flocks of chairs and people on foot all making for Summertown. Even Fever began to look interested as the breeze blew fairground noises in through the open windows, jingling music and bellowing foghorn voices. She remembered Dr. Crumb telling her how some of the land barges travelled all the way to Vishnustan and Kerala. Even Zagwa, the crazy Christian empire which had conquered most of Africa and southern Europe and banned all technology there, still permitted land barges to visit the free trade zones along its borders. By the time they stepped out of the chair onto litter-strewn grass between the big barrel-shaped wheels and clay-clagged tracks of the barges, Fever was as wide-eyed as the children. Kit Solent paid the bearers and took Fern's hand, while Ruin ran ahead, shouting back to draw Fever's attention to his favourite barges. There was a boy who strode about on stilts, and a man who was juggling with shining knives. "You must not try that at home, Fern," Fever warned the little girl, remembering her role as the rational member of their party. "There was a man who was busy sawing a woman in half. Or that," she added. "I expect it is all done with mirrors." A barker on the deck of a barge shouted at them through a big tin trumpet, inviting them to climb the boarding plank and see for themselves the lizard girl and the three-headed goat. "Mutations, no doubt," said Fever, looking at the scary pictures painted on the barge's stern. "It would be unkind to go and stare at them." Ruin and Fern sighted a stall selling candy floss, and their father bought three sticks. "It has no nutritional value whatsoever," said Fever, looking doubtfully at the pink cloud he handed her. She stretched her head forward, wary of getting the stuff on her coat. It tasted as it looked, scratchy and sticky and very pink. Not nice, not exactly.
but fun. Fern thrust Noodle Poodle into her father's hand and ran off after Ruin, both children gripping their candy floss sticks like pink banners as they hurried to watch a fire eater performing. Fever half wanted to go with them, but she told herself it was not dignified for an engineer to gulp at vulgar entertainments. While Kit Solent strolled after the children, she hung behind, eating her candy floss with awkward, bird-like movements of her head and an expression which was meant to signal to anyone watching her that she was not enjoying it, just tasting it in a spirit of scientific inquiry. And as she ate, she stopped to stare at the strange events on the open stage at the rear of a barge called Persimmon's Ambulatory Lyceum, where actors, dressed in cardboard armour, were talking too loudly to one another in front of a painted landscape. "It is all make-believe," Fever thought. "The words, the clothes, the things. That's not a real sword, and I'm sure that man's beard is made of wool. Even the people are pretending to be other people. Why would anyone waste their time watching such stuff?" Yet people were. Quite a crowd had gathered before the stage, and a pretty girl, who seemed not to be needed in the play just then, was strolling amongst them with a basket, into which they threw their offerings. It was like a symbol for all the foolishness of the world outside the head, and Fever was still staring at it when a hand came down on her shoulder from behind. It gripped her firmly, though not painfully, and turned her. She dropped the candy floss and wiped pink stickiness from her mouth on the back of her hand. A gaunt white face stared down at her. Hard old eyes, pale as glass in the shadow of a tattered hat brim. A rough voice that said, "Excuse me, miss, I needs a word." But it didn't seem to be a word the stranger wanted so much as a long, hard look. His pale eyes roved over Fever's face as if he were reading her. He frowned. "What are you?" he muttered. Fever gave a violent shrug, and the old man's hand fell from her shoulder. She turned away from him, almost knocking over the shabby boy who seemed to have sprung up behind her like a mushroom out of the littered grass. She scanned the crowds between the barges and saw the fire-eater's burning breath flare up like a beacon, guiding her to where Kit Solent was. Hurrying toward him, she looked back and saw the old man and the boy standing, watching her. They were the same pair who had been watching the house that morning, she was sure. "All right, Fever?" asked Kit, when she writhed through between the other spectators and arrived beside him. She nodded, wiping at her mouth again. She did not want him to think that she could not be left alone for 30 seconds without trouble finding her. The old man had mistaken her for someone else, that was all. That was the rational explanation. She calmed herself and looked sceptically at the fire-eater in his roped-off ring. "I do not believe that he is really eating that at all."
Chapter 11 Master Worm Timber. That afternoon, at the hour when the low sun shone flickering through the wheels of wind trams as they rumbled above the streets, Bagman Creech and Charlie went down Cripplegate and turned right along Bankment Side. A wind huffed at them off the brick marsh, but it could not quite blow away the acrid smell of the big vats where scraps of plastic dug up from the fields around the city were being melted down and remoulded. They crossed one and then another of the slimy timber bridges which spanned the streams flowing into the marsh. People coming the other way stood aside for the Skinner, bobbing bows and curtsies, and he nodded back and rested one hand on Charlie's shoulder, letting the town know the boy was with him. Charlie was getting used to his new life by then. He liked the way people called out to wish Bagman luck, and parents pointed him out to their children, and the children stared round-eyed at the old man stalking by, and stared at Charlie too, because although he was no bigger or better dressed than most of them, he was lit up by some of the Skinner's glory. At last Bagman stopped at a tall, shabby warehouse with a painted sign above the door.
"Worm Timber's Historic Curios," he read out, for Charlie's benefit. "We'll have to teach you to read, son, if you're to be a Skinner's boy."
Inside, the place was more like a cave than a shop. Stacked with old car parts and barrels of machine scraps, ancient technology heaped up against the walls and dangling from the rafters. The owner popped out of a secret lair among the clutter and blinked at them. Bagman? Charlie knew the man, of course. Knew him by sight, at least, for Thaniel Wormtimber was one of Ted Swiney's cronies, and could be found most evenings propping up the Mott and Hoople's bar. He was small and walnut-brown and dirty, and he had large, watchful yellow eyes.
"Charlie," the Skinner said, "this here is Master Wormtimber. He's the new council's master of devices, but I believe he won't be above lending us a helping hand."
"Always happy to help the Skinners' Guilds, Master Creech," replied Worm Timber, rubbing his little mittened hands over and over each other like a cat washing its paws. His head twitched forward, and those weaselish eyes looked hungrily at Charlie. "Oh, always happy, Master Creech. Ted Swiney at the Motton Hoople told me you were hunting again, but I didn't dare imagine that I might be of any use."
"You keep an eye on the digs around town, I believe. You keep the council abreast of who's digging where and what they're finding."
"Oh, yes, indeed, Master Creech. That is one of my duties."
"What do you know about an archaeologist called Solent?"
Worm Timber blinked cautiously. "Kit Solent? He's nothing much. He married old Chigley Unthank's daughter. The daughter's dead too now, I believe. Solent's never found anything of much note. What makes him Skinner's business, Master Creech?" Creech said nothing for a moment. Charlie sensed that the old man was uneasy about sharing what he'd found with the Master of Devices. But he coughed, and then said,
"Solent's hired a new engineer. A girl."
Worm Timber nodded. "Crumb's foundling. I've heard of her."
"What do you mean, foundling?"
"Why, I mean what I say, Master Creech, that she was found. In a basket. On the brick marsh somewhere. Fever Crumb." He stopped, and his eyes seemed to light with a pale fire. "I say, Master Creech, you don't suspect she's one of them?"
"It ain't proven neither way," said Creech. "I've had a look at her, but I can't be certain. I need to get in and check her over without actually getting in and checking her over, if you take my meaning. I heard you're the man to come to for the old machines."
"Oh, yes, Master Creech, sir," said Worm Timber, nodding, rubbing his hands, smiling so much that his eyes folded themselves away into deep creases. "I do have some most interesting devices at my disposal. Say what you will about the Patchskins, they left behind some lovely toys. Old tech weapons, sir, and spyware. As Master of Devices, it's my task to maintain such things for the new council, but between ourselves, the post pays poorly. And so to make ends meet, I do sometimes rent out or even sell the more useful pieces. Though, of course, I had not dreamed to expect a rental fee from you, Master Creech. I'm always pleased to help the Skinners. So this girl, you say, this girl who may be, or may not be, we need a close look at her, do we? A sneaky peek while she's asleep." He gave a little slithery giggle. "Oh, yes, I think that can be done. Come back tonight when it grows dark, and we shall see what we shall see." Some miles outside the inhabited city, where the sparse brown grasses blew on hummocks of brick and tarmac that had once been streets, the orbital moatway marked the borders of Greater London. An ancient feature, built up and fortified in Scriven times, it curved through the heaths and fields like a thick green snake. A deep dike and an embankment topped with a wall of salvage stone and a timber palisade. A stone guard tower stood sentry every mile, looking south toward the channel ports, east to the Minnakies of Upnor and Doggerland on the salt plains where the North Sea used to roll, west to the marches of Reading and north toward, well, nothing much. North of the moatway there were only more hummocks, more dun grass, the huts and fields of an occasional small settlement, and sometimes, in clear weather, on the edge of sight, the blunt, dirty snouts of far-off glaciers, squatting in the haze that hung forever above the ice sheet. Until that evening. That evening, there was something new. In the afternoon, some of the moatway lookouts had noticed that a part of the northern sky was striped with dozens of grey lines, which rose straight up and spread into a stain, like the bruise of smoke that might hang above a dense concentration of chimneys. As the sun went down and the shadows deepened, they began to see lights beneath the smoke, dozens of lights, yellow and white like distant lighted windows, flickering red like far-off furnaces. It was as if a mirage of the city were forming itself out there, a mirror London conjured from the tawny heaths and cold meltwater lakes. The watchmen, whose job it was to guard the moatway against foreigners, gathered on the palisades. They stood in worried clumps on the battlements of the mile castles, fingering the hafts of their pikes, the stocks of their clumsy muskets. Officers trained telescopes on the distant smoke. "Things are moving, throwing up a lot of dust, but big things, land barges. There's a whole city on the move out there." A moving city. That's how things were up in the wild and fridgy marches of the north. Up there, the tribes who had been set wandering by the plagues and firestorms of the downsizing had never settled down again the way sensible people had in warmer climates. They'd just kept going,
century after century, millennium after millennium. They'd started out on foot, tramping after their herds. Then they had built wagons, and the wagons had become motorized, and the motors had grown more powerful, and the wagons had grown larger, turning into barges, land hoys, and traction castles. And still they kept moving, too in love with their wandering life to ever settle now. And now, for the first time since the Scriven came, some of them had moved within sight of the borders of London. The men on the motorway could only look and wonder, taking turns with the most powerful telescopes. Meanwhile, out of the scrublands and the scattered northern digger villages, the first grey-brown bundled processions of refugees were streaming, battering at the motorway's gates to be let through. Women carrying children, children carrying babies, an old man wearing a cheap chest of drawers on his back like a rucksack. "Let us in!" Their thin, chilly voices scratched at the air like the voices of sheep. "Let us through! They are coming! The movement is coming!"
Chapter 12. The Foldable Assassin. Darkness settled over Ludgate Hill. The children went to bed, tired and contented. Ruin made a space on his bedside table for the toy land barge that his father had bought him at the fair, and fell asleep gazing at it. Fern snuggled against Noodle Poodle's blue fur and dreamed small, happy dreams. Upstairs, Fever recited logarithms to herself until she had cleared her head of all the dizzy memories of Summertown before she went to bed. After a little while longer, Kit Solent turned in too. The house lay quiet for a long time. A clock ticked in the hallway, and another in the drawing room. A brown beetle hurried across the living room floor. Wands of moonlight reached slowly through the silent rooms. Just before midnight, with a papery rasp, something was pushed through the letter flap of the street door and fell with a soft thump on the mat. It lay there for a silent while among the children's kicked-off shoes, a dim block of white in the gloom of the hall, like a tightly folded newspaper. Then, if you had been watching, you might have seen a shy, sly movement. A corner curled. It settled again, cautious, as if waiting to make sure no one had noticed. Then, very swiftly, with quick, crinkling, crisping noises that were almost too faint to hear, the paper boy unfolded itself and stood upright, balancing on the edges of its flat, white feet. Its blank face swung to and fro, scanning the emptiness of the hall. Outside, Charlie Shallow hurried away from the house, afraid that some passerby would have spotted him cramming the folded paper through Solent's door. But no one challenged him. He ran across the empty street, ducked into an alleyway, and pounded on the door of a big sedan chair that waited there, its four bearers dozing between the shafts. After a moment, the door opened, and he was pulled inside. One of the chair's seats was taken up by a strange machine, all copper wire and twisty brass tubes and complicated little lead boxes, with a tiny screen glowing in the middle of it all. Faniel Wormtimber had clipped a magnifying lens in front of the screen, and he sat on the opposite seat, his feet working the pedals that powered the contraption, his hands gripping a set of brass levers, his eyes peering fiercely at the flickering picture. Beside him, statue still, sat Bagman Creech.
"We're in,"
said Wormtimber, in an excited sort of whisper that kept threatening to turn into a giggle.
"That's Solent's hallway." "It's hard to see much,"
said Bagman, unimpressed.
"All blurs and splodges. Can't you make it clearer?"
"Make it clearer?" snapped Wormtimber. "This is old, old technology from the Black Centuries, Master Creech. We're lucky it works at all. If anyone knew how to improve it, they'd have done so. Paperboy's eyes sense heat, not light. Those dark grey bits are cold, the light grey are warmer. Warmest of all will be living things like this girl of yours. Let's see if we can find her."
He pedalled a little harder, and the tiny picture flickered brighter, like a grey moth trapped behind the magnifying lens. The paper boy went rustling across the hall and started upstairs. It walked jerkily, leaning forward like a man walking into a gale. As it passed the landing windows, moonlight shone through it. If you had been watching, you might have seen the wafer mechanisms pressed between its paper layers, the wires of its bones, thin as horsehairs, the shadows of its electric eyes in the blank page of its face. It moved along the landing to a bedroom, hesitated a moment, then folded itself to the floor and posted itself under the door like a note. In the chair outside, Bagman Creech leaned closer to the tiny screen and made out the fuzzy white shapes of the Solent children sleeping in their beds.
That's not her. Move on.
The paperboy went crisping and crinkling on its way. It climbed more stairs and crept toward the door at the end of the landing. It spilled through the crack beneath it like a paper flood. Fever was sleeping on her back, as always, her hands by her sides. The paperboy circled the bed like her own bleached shadow sprung to life. It studied the neat piles of her clothes and the picture she had taken down propped up carefully against the wall. It came close to the bed and leaned over her, its flat, dead face above her sleeping one. It raised one hand and flexed it, with a sound like someone smoothing out a screwed-up banknote. It stretched its forefinger, and with a ripping sound no louder than Fever's breathing, a curved needle tore out through the paper. It was a sharp little hypodermic claw, and it glinted in the moonlight spilling round the edges of the curtain. Out in the sedan chair, Worm Timber moistened his lips with the tip of his pink tongue and wiped the palms of his hands against his robes. He was giggling softly, and when he giggled he actually said, "Tee-hee-hee." A little needle, Bagman. That's how the Patchskins used paperboys to kill off their enemies and rivals. Fold away assassins. A fingertip needle connected to a sack of venom. Now, just a jab in her pretty neck. Just a little prick. Tee-hee-hee.
You'll respect that girl, Worm Timber. For all we know, she's as human as you or I. I ain't ever killed a human being yet, and I don't mean to start now.
I know, Master Creech, I know. You don't want her dead, you just want proof.
Fever frowned and stirred as the needle pierced her skin. After a moment, the paperboy stepped back. There was a bead of blood on Fever's neck. She turned on her side, murmuring something. She opened her eyes and half-lifted her head from the pillow, but the paperboy turned sideways onto her and stood motionless, almost invisible. When she had settled, it went back across the room and slid itself out under the door again. It walked back down the stairs. It stopped on the front doormat and started to crumple. It screwed itself up small and bundled itself out through the letter flap. Outside, it went bounding and tumbling away along the street, and if you'd been watching then, you might have thought it just a bit of wind-blown litter, except that there was no wind, and it moved too purposefully, rounding the corner and rustling into an alley, where it fetched up against the door of Worm Timber's sedan chair. Charlie scrambled out, picked up the bundle of dirty paper, and passed it inside. Then he set about waking the drowsing bearers. Inside the chair, Worm Timber uncrumpled the paperboy. He found its hand and lifted it into the light of the now blank screen. There was a tiny, rust-brown smudge on the forefinger. Beneath the paper, a small sack bulged, filled with the blood of Fever Crumb.
Chapter 13. Morning After the Night Before. In her dreams that night, Fever returned to Nonsuch House. Not by the tunnel this time, but across Godsork's old causeway and up a gravelled path to where the fine, unruined house stood waiting for her. There were lights in the windows, music and perfume on the evening air, and the lamps of London twinkling across the marshes in the twilight. She walked on the lawns, watching servants light big paper float lanterns and set them free to rise into the sky, their glow reflecting in the ponds. The sedan chairs of the party guests stood on the drive like wardrobes lined up at an outdoor furniture sale. Dr. Crumb was there, and Fever felt proud that she would be able to show him her house and her vault beneath it, filled with wonders. She woke with a gasp, her mouth still full of the taste of the wine that she had been drinking in her dream. The scent of some pricey, bespoke perfume hung in her memory like fog. Her neck hurt, and when she touched the place she felt a tender, raised lump. Chymex lectularius, she thought. It was hardly surprising that an irrational old house like Kit Solent's should be infested by the common bedbug. She threw off the covers and went down to the bathroom to dash water at her face. It was light outside. She looked in the mirror and felt slightly disappointed to see her own bald, big-eyed self staring out at her, as if she had been expecting someone better. A peach fuzz of sandy down furred her scalp. She reached for her razor, then changed her mind. Why should she not have hair? She was not in Godsork's head any more. Downstairs, to the clatter and chatter of the conservatory. The smells of coffee, fresh-baked bread, fried bacon, fishy dishes Fever didn't know the names of. The children falling quiet as she walked in, still shy of her, although she did her best to smile encouragingly at them. Kit Solent was reading the London Alarmist, holding it up in front of him with one hand while he buttered toast with the other. "Sleep well, Miss Crumb?" he asked. "Yes," said Feather, and then, seeing no cause to lie, "no. I had irrational dreams about none such house." "You didn't happen to dream the code to get us through that door, I suppose?" He waved the newspaper at her as he put it down.